How have you not seen this? And welcome back to How Have You Not Seen This. As always, it's me, your host, Dustin Meadows. Today I'm joined by my friend Sumak Torgalkar.
Hey, Dustin.
Hey. And today we watched American Psycho, based on the Bret Easton Ellis novel of the same name, directed by Mary Harron. Really great movie, one of Christian Bale's greatest performances of all time, I think. Sumak, how have you not seen this?
Well, it's a long story, but it started, like, I watched it in high school, technically.
Okay.
Not really, though. Like, I was hanging out with some friends, and it might be a testament to my friends that they popped in this movie, of all things.
Uh-huh.
But then you just get to talking with friends, and you're not actually really watching the movie.
Of course.
So there's maybe a scene or two that I remember when watching it again, but I didn't really watch the movie. But then you get it in the back of your head like you really did watch the movie, so
yeah.
You don't prioritize it anymore in your life. So then years later, I was actually listening to a podcast with Anthony Jeselnik.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was WTF with Mark Maron. And he said his favorite author was Bret Easton Ellis.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I thought, oh yeah, I've always been meaning to read like a Bret Easton Ellis novel. The one that stood out to me was American Psycho. So I read it with the intention that like, oh okay, I'll read the book and then truly watch the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the time, I did not have a Netflix subscription.
Yeah.
So how I would go about watching movies was to like just request movies from the library and then get them and watch them. But in this case, I looked up American Psycho at the Columbus Library and they only had one copy of American Psycho 2, which made no sense.
No.
So ultimately, like, I would have had to find somebody who owned it or, you know, whatever. I just put it on the back shelf because I was like, well, I can't find a copy of this movie then, or eventually I'll watch it, I guess. But it turned out quite fitting that we watch it together, I think. And talk about it.
Cool. Yeah, American Psycho 2, I've seen 10 minutes of it.
What is it, though?
It is a tenuous, at best, sequel, starring Mila Kunis. The tie-in is that her babysitter is dating Patrick Bateman, and then Patrick Bateman kills her babysitter while she's, like, hiding under the bed or something. And then I think Patrick Bateman, like, just leaves. So that, like, that's the connection. And then she's a college girl, and she just kills people.
Men?
Yeah, like, she just kills people.
It's like Next Karate Kid of America.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I feel like William Shatner is in it, and he's one of, like, her teachers that he kills. Yeah, it's very bizarre. It's weird that it exists.
So is it, like, in the 90s or the 2000s
that
the movie takes place in?
I don't remember when. I've only seen probably like the first half hour before. Mm-hmm. I was like, what am I doing? And like,
yeah.
I stopped. Like, I can sit through bad movies, but like, even I've got my threshold.
Right.
Cool. So, you liked American Psycho?
I did.
Not like it? Okay, cool.
But I think it tailors to what my interests are as a moviegoer.
Okay.
You know, my favorite movie is Taxi Driver.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
I love films that are character studies.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly anti-heroes, as well as just, you know, people that are unbalanced, and it's like, where is this unbalance coming from?
Yeah.
And that's why I think I was always drawn, it was just weird to me that I hadn't watched American Psycho up until this point, because it is the type of movie that I really enjoy, and I did.
Yeah, good, absolutely. Like I said earlier, this is hands down probably my favorite Christian Bale role.
Mm-hmm.
Like, obviously, I love him in almost everything he's in, like the Batman movies, the Prestige, anytime he's with Nolan. But this is my favorite role. I think this is the best role he's ever done.
Yeah.
And I love that it's so dark and satirical.
Right.
And it's really funny too. Like if you can get on board with the darker stuff, it's actually a really funny movie too.
Yeah. Is there a point though that you felt wrong laughing? Because to me, it was kind of a test of how screwed up I am.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? And I, like, there's the scene where he just shoots that security guard point blank.
Yeah, yeah.
And I laughed.
Yeah.
But it's at a point where you're like, I should feel wrong for laughing, but it's too funny to not laugh.
Yeah.
And then the weirdest part is, to me, you get so immune to the killing mm-hmm. that the most shocking part is when he's going to kill the stray cat.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
what I mean? Like, it's a real, it's weird how your mind ends up working, where you're like, whoa, you're going to go that far to kill that cat?
Yeah.
Rather than the crazy murders you've already done.
Yeah. Well, he killed a dog earlier, too.
Right. That was also vicious.
Yeah.
And uncomfortable.
Steps on the dog. Like, yeah. I feel like the parts where he was going to murder animals were more uncomfortable to me than when he was actually killing people.
Right.
And I think that's just a trait of, like, a lot of people.
Yeah.
Because when we did the Jaws episode with Andy and Danny, we were talking about how a dog gets killed in that movie, but you never really, like, you never see animals get killed on screen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even, like, an Old Yeller, like, it's implied. Like, you see the pull the trigger and you hear, like, the whine as it gets shot. But, like, you never actually see him. But here we see him, like, stab people. We see him drop a chainsaw on a lady. Mm-hmm. But we never actually see him do anything to the animals.
Right. But it might be a subtle commentary, too, on our own human reactions.
Yeah.
Or our own, just general in society at this point, or also just with this film, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wanted to ask you, though, in comparing it to Taxi Driver and films similarly like this,
yeah.
the use of voiceover, like,
yeah.
how do you react to that? Because, like, there's that hilarious part in Adaptation where, like, Sid Field is, like, voiceover is such a cheap way of doing, or whatever, you know, a cheap approach to handling plot
yeah.
in a film. But in character studies like this one, it's almost necessary.
Yeah, I think it's appropriate, because the whole movie, our point of view is from Patrick Bateman.
Mm-hmm.
In Taxi Driver, our point of view is Travis Bickle. It makes sense that we're seeing the world as he sees it. And I think that actually ties to the ending of both those films, not to, like, talk too much about Taxi Driver, because I don't want to ruin it for anybody listening. I'll save that for when I do a Taxi Driver episode. If they listen to the Taxi Driver episode and they haven't seen him, that's their own dumb fault.
Right.
But I think Taxi Driver and American Psycho are similar in their endings that way, too,
mm-hmm.
where it's kind of that unreliable narrator, and you don't know what's real and what isn't anymore.
Sure.
And I think in a case like that, I think the internal monologue, the voiceover narration, I think that's totally appropriate.
Yeah. And I think, if I'm correct, we're never taken away from Patrick Bateman's viewpoint, either.
No.
I think there's only one small scene in Taxi Driver where you're taken away from his viewpoint, and it's really odd.
Yeah.
But in American Psycho, yeah, so the voiceover is true to what
yeah,
the film is.
Yeah, every scene is Patrick Bateman. Like,
yeah.
I think the longest is maybe, like, for, like, example, like, that scene when he walks in on Lewis in the bathroom when he's about to strangle him before Lewis starts kissing
right.
him. Like, there's the 5 seconds before he walks into the bathroom, but he's in that scene.
Right.
So, yeah, he's present throughout the entire film.
And I think, now that I think about just that Chloe Savini looking at his...
Yeah, yeah, that's the only one.
Only thing.
And the rest of it, yeah, it's... We're with him throughout the whole thing. And I think part of it, too, like, the reason I feel okay laughing, part of it is just, it's clearly a send-up of, like, yuppie culture, kind of that materialistic, like, that wealthy aspect. And, I mean, I often tend to go very class warrior, even when I don't intend to.
Right.
So, like, I'm all for ripping into, like, the wealthy, like, the 1% or whatever.
Yeah.
So,
this is a weird question, but have you ever hung out with anyone who works on Wall Street?
No.
Okay. I have.
Okay.
But it's like they were Wall Street normal, whereas you and I are, like, stand-up comedy normal,
uh-huh.
if you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
So, what is in American Psycho is excess of excess.
Yeah.
But these guys are still excessive, too.
Yeah.
In being normal Wall Street guys. But they're just, like, they're excessive about money,
mm-hmm.
whereas we as stand-up comedians are excessive about nothing that we have.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
We're complaining about $20 that we didn't get on the show,
yeah,
whereas
yeah.
they're complaining about, you know, whatever Wall Street related that's like hundreds of thousands of dollars
yeah.
or more. And they're consumed by it much in the same way we're consumed by, you know, the things that come with comedy that are so
yeah.
meaningless.
Yeah,
they're consumed by their jobs because they're working at it constantly. And when it comes down to it, you know, yes, it's the basis of our economy, but at the same time, it's also a lot of meaningless stuff. Like,
yeah.
like, I don't know, to me hedge funds are just as meaningless as setups to jokes.
but
they're a part of like what our worlds are to make what we do.
Yeah, definitely.
And we obsess over it. And yeah, I just think there's not something so far off other than class to what makes these two types of people very
weird. As far as like on paper, very similar motivations. Right. Yeah, I would agree with that. I think my favorite thing in this movie that summed that up as far as like the unnecessary things, the business card scene.
Yeah.
When they're all showing off their cards to each other, and Patrick Bateman is just having this internal breakdown over not having the best business card.
Yeah.
Like, that's such a great scene. And then later to the point where he's motivated to murder another person because his business card looks nicer than his.
Right.
And just all these scenes where he's lamenting things like, he says there's one point where he's on the verge of tears when they go out to dinner the first time because he thinks they're going to have a shitty table.
Yeah.
It's like, I would just be happy to have a seat at a place like that.
Sure.
And that's insane to me, like, that somebody is so fixated on so many, like, such unnecessary just things like that. It blows my mind.
Yeah, it's pretty nuts. But really well done.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
The setup to the movie, there's so many ways this movie could have been done wrong.
Yes,
like, you know what I mean?
Easily.
And like I said, I read the book, and it's very hard to translate a book that is so internal into a film. So, like, for example, the Genesis and Whitney Houston and Huey Lewis and the
News, all
types
those music
of things,
reviews.
What it could have been something so internal.
Yeah.
And you're just hearing music in the background. But they allowed it to flow conversationally, where it was really indicative of the character, too.
Yeah, and it was completely natural for him. Like,
right.
He's doing that at no point. I'm like, this is kind of weird that he's talking about Huey Lewis's album 4.
Yeah.
No, it's like, this is perfectly normal that Patrick Bateman is doing this right now.
Right.
I've read, I want to say, a little over half of the book.
Okay.
And I got fed up with the descriptions, because it just got to be too much when I was like, I get it. Like,
right.
He's fixated on these things. You're beating me over the head with a Bret Easton Ellis.
Right.
So, like, I want to say I stopped reading somewhere after he kills Paul Allen, I think.
Yeah.
I think is when I stopped reading.
Gotcha.
Like, and at this point, like, I remember almost nothing, specific details from the book, just because all I could remember was reading descriptions of things and reviews of, like, music that he was talking about.
Because if I remember, it was, like, a whole chapter devoted to Genesis, as a Genesis fan, like, I'm like, this is awesome. But obviously, for what it is in trying to implement that into the movie, that's a challenge that they did very well.
Yeah, they knocked it out of the park with that, I think.
Here's another thing I just am curious about.
Uh-huh.
So I thought this was really, like, if American Psycho were made in 2013, or the book came out at a later time,
okay,
and then the movie was adapted, I don't know why I said 2013 when it's 2014, but whatever. I was working with this Oscars.
Yeah.
I just think that the number of pop culture references for when this movie came out was kind of a fitting thing and very new to what both literature and film was at the time.
Yeah, definitely.
But now we've had so many movies that make tons of pop culture references and throw that into the plot that it wouldn't feel the same way.
Yeah.
It was very, I don't know, because I could put it in the context of the time in which the book was released, that to me it was like, well, this was a real unique thing.
Yeah.
Whereas now it would be like, oh, a Genesis reference, oh, a Whitney Houston reference.
Exactly,
like,
yeah.
It really seemed like appreciation in this book and movie, whereas now it would just be like yet another pop culture
reference. Yeah,
yeah,
and it's like it has no substance to it. I think this and High Fidelity both do that really well.
Yeah,
like,
that's true.
It's like they revolve basically around like these characters, like love of these things. Granted, like one's just about a guy who's feeling heartbroken because he got dumped, and the other's, you know, a psychopathic Wall Street dude.
Right.
But like, they're both coming from a clear point of appreciation and admiration for those things. So when he sits there talking about Huey Lewis, or when John Cusack's talking about Springsteen, or whatever other number of musical artists he talks about, it's like, oh, this is what's important to this character. This is natural. This isn't them shoehorning something in. I think the best example I can think of, This Is the End, which came out last year, a really funny movie. And then they it ends with that sequence of them in heaven and just the Backstreet Boys doing a musical number for literally no reason.
Right.
Like, that, I thought they really shat the bed on the ending on that.
Yeah.
It was like, cool, like, I'm really attached to this, and it really is like this big, epic scale kind of world-ending thing going on, and then you just phone in that last thing for, like, the cheap joke of, like, hey, remember the Backstreet Boys? and that ruins the movie for me. Like, it kills it. Like, that kept it from being one of my favorite movies last year. Because up until that point, I liked everything about it. And then they did this cheap thing that I feel like all the people involved in that movie are so above doing.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I just kind of look at it as, I don't know. It's pretty impressive how fitting it was for when it came out.
Yeah.
And how if it were at a different time, it just would not have the impact, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think it could still be done. It would have to be made right. And I feel like the chances for it to be made right now with, like, current sensibilities as far as, like, movie making, definitely be a lot harder than it was, I want to say, like, 12, 13 years ago when it came out.
Right. Is it... Okay, this is so fitting of me, too, that I took notes.
No, I'm all for that.
And then secondly, I wrote them on a Taco Bell napkin because we ate at Taco Bell.
Yeah, we
but
did.
But we both love Taco Bell.
And, Taco Bell, proud sponsor of the podcast.
Why not? And films with unbalanced people.
Yep.
wait, I don't know anything about Mary Harron.
Okay.
What other films?
She, the only, I remember Mary Harron solely because we talked about her in a film class that I did when I was in college. She directed a biopic about Betty Page.
Oh, okay.
That was the only other thing, like, that I remember seeing her do. I'll look it up really quick, because I'm kind of curious,
well,
too.
It's one of those things where the credits were starting, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And all I really remembered was Christian Bale, obviously, and Willem Dafoe.
Yeah.
And then people's names keep popping up, and I'm like, oh my god, this person was in the movie? This person was
in
the
Chloe
movie?
Sevigny, Justin Theroux, who's been in a bunch of David
Reese
Wayne
Witherspoon.
Movies.
Yeah.
Josh Lucas,
right,
who was actually in Sweet Home Alabama with Reese Witherspoon. I want to say it was just before this came out or just after it, but it was around the same time, yeah.
Right, so it just kind of kept piling on of actors who, at the time, were on the cusp of, you know, fame, and except Willem Dafoe,
really.
But a lot of them just became something big. So that's why I was like, well, who directed this movie? I don't even remember who directed it. And then when I saw her name pop up, I said, I'm not sure I'm completely familiar with her.
Yeah.
And if I am, like, I didn't realize she directed other movies that I might have seen.
Yeah, like, I'm trying to pull it up right now. Because I knew that she had done this in the Betty Page movie. And I like this a lot. Let's see. Oh, she did I Shot Andy Warhol. And the Notorious Betty Page is the Betty Page movie. I'm pulling up filmography. And she did The Moth Diaries. Wow, that's the most recent thing she has done. That was 2011. And she just executive produced that. So the Betty Page biopic was 2005, came out after American Psycho.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the last film that she directed, apparently. Which is really bizarre, because this movie's really good.
Yeah. We'll have to look more into that later.
Yeah.
Like, in the sense of maybe it's on her own decision. Or maybe it's one of those weird things like the Boondock Saints director, where maybe she just pissed a lot of people off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I could give a shit about Troy Duffy. I fucking hate that.
Well,
guy.
I don't.
But
I was just using it
but
as
yeah, but no, that's
of,
but that's a perfect
very,
example, though.
It's very weird how sometimes... Well, we're in... We care a lot about who creates...
Absolutely,
movies.
Yeah.
And sometimes movies happen and the director kind of just sweeps away. Like,
yeah.
And this might be a case of it, like I said, where you kind of just forget that because all these other people involved in it trumped it.
Yeah, overpowered it.
And
that
that's
name.
Why, you know, whereas if this was, I don't know, Alfonso Cuarón directed it, we'd be like, oh, it's another Alfonso Cuarón movie.
Yeah.
But
so it's like, oh, Mary.
Yeah. Right. I was just waiting for a director's name where I'd be like, oh, wow.
Oh, that makes sense.
And instead I was like, okay, I need to, like, look this up. So, I don't know. That was the thing that kind of stood out to me, just from the start with the opening credits.
Yeah.
Great music, though, too.
Yeah, the music's solid. The score is I get haunting, I think, is the best, like,
yeah.
Like, even that bathroom scene where, like, he just walks in and, like, you feel, like, even, like, going into it, like, you know that he's going to try to kill him, but, like, it also gives you the feeling, like, he's probably not actually going to kill him in this bathroom. Like, something's going to happen.
Yeah.
And, like, it, yeah, the music is just unnerving.
When did you first watch this movie?
I want to say I watched it, it was in college the first time I saw it. I want to say I saw it somewhere around 2007, 2008.
Okay.
In there.
So, from my recollection of it,
uh-huh.
It did not have a good theatrical run, right?
I don't know how well. I mean, it made its budget back. It did well financially. It made $34 million against a budget of $7 million.
Oh.
So wow. Financially, it did well. And I think critically, but like it was definitely one of those like ones where it kind of snuck in there,
yeah.
Did decent, and then was out. Like it certainly wasn't. It wasn't like an Avatar or like an Avengers or anything like that, obviously.
Right. I think, I know this is a weird thing to just say, but I look at it as kind of a dramatic Office Space.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
I can see
it
that.
Came out, but it didn't have the impact it should have when it came out to
yeah.
me. And then it was like everybody started watching it on mm-hmm. DVD and just kept talking about it
yeah.
and how really good it was.
I think this is definitely one of those ones that like kind of enjoyed like The Big Lebowski, too, where, like,
right.
it's enjoyed kind of that post-theatrical success more than anything.
Yeah.
I know, like, because I want to say I bought this DVD, I think the first time I watched it was when I bought this DVD, because
yeah.
It was the Best Buy for, like, $5 for, and it was a special edition. I was like, oh, I've always wanted to watch this. It's Christian Bale. I like Christian Bale a lot. Like, he'd already played Batman twice, so I was on board. And at that point, like, usually, if I see a movie for sale, if it's $3 or $4, I'll buy it because it usually costs that much to rent it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, worst case scenario, I'm out $3 or $4 anyway. Best case scenario, I like it. Now I own it. So
right, but it just didn't. It didn't. It wasn't an award.
No, I don't. I think it might have been nominated for like screenplay or something like that.
Right,
but yeah, definitely not.
And it was it technically in the independent realm at all?
Yes, definitely, okay. Definitely independent film.
Yeah, since $7 million.
Yeah, yeah. It was 2000 when it came out, so it came out when I was still in high school, actually. Mm. But yeah, it's definitely in that under that radar. But yeah, I don't understand how that works either. I guess I don't know what makes a movie successful after it's in the theaters, like. I remember seeing the trailer for it when it came out and being kind of, like, I wasn't sure really how to feel. Because, like, the trailer is so weird, too. Like, I feel like the trailer, makes you think there's going to be a lot more murder in the movie, I guess.
Mm.
Like, you think it's going to be more of a horror film than, like, just this glimpse of, like, this fucked up character.
Yeah, well, it had to be kind of really hard for a marketer to
yeah,
try
definitely.
To sell this movie.
Oh, yeah.
In general, let alone via a trailer.
Yeah,
to
absolutely.
To kind of convey what it's even about.
Yeah, trailers, yeah, it's tricky. I think, I know you mentioned Taxi Driver. Have you seen Observe and Report?
No, but I heard a Seth Rogen interview where he kind of had that connection of Travis Bickle. Wait a minute, no, I did see it.
Yeah.
Anna Faris is in it too, right?
Yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that movie.
Yeah, and I think that movie, I had to see it 3 times before I finally decided how I felt about it.
Right.
And it was largely because the trailer sold it like a straight Seth Rogen comedy.
Yeah.
And it's not that. Like,
right.
It really is. It's the closest thing since American Psycho to, like, a Taxi Driver type film.
Right.
Where you've got this tormented, like, character who... maybe there's a reason he's not this hero that he's supposed to be, because he's completely fucked.
Right.
But you see the trailer and you're like, oh, Seth Rogen's being goofy with some pals. Cool, I'll go watch this.
Yeah.
And it's always a shame. And I think that's probably, you're right, that's probably part of why this movie maybe didn't crack at first, because nobody really knew what it was.
Right. Well, you mentioned, yeah, Observe and Report, I watched.
Yeah.
I can't believe I forgot I watched it, but... yeah, it just didn't do it for me. It was what it was, but I didn't
yeah.
think it was anything special
yeah.
or in that same realm of, like, a Taxi Driver. I understood where they were trying to go, but
yeah.
I was like, yeah, this is okay. But when you're watching this, were there little parts where you thought of other movies? Because I don't know. Like, I could not think of A Clockwork Orange when you've got a mixture of music
with kind of
and brutality. Sterile
sets.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that too. That's a really good point of just the colors, too.
That I actually, it's funny you mentioned that because this time when he was chasing one of the prostitute down the hallway with the chainsaw, all I could think of was fucking Kubrick movies because of those long, like, just blank slate hallways.
Yeah.
So yeah, I definitely thought of that.
Yeah.
Went to Kubrick and Clockwork Orange a lot.
I also felt kind of a, like, Catch-22, Fight Club-ish element where you don't know what's real.
Yeah.
People are believing what they want to believe, and it's just a real, I love that type of movie, too, because it's indicative of, I mean, with Catch-22, indicative of bureaucracy, which wasn't far off from what they were, what's going on with an American Psycho, too.
Yeah, well, especially with that that big final action sequence where, like, he's shooting cops and stuff. Like, the second one of those cars blew up was like, I'm not sure if this is actually happening or not.
Yeah.
And the fact he never reloads. Like, he fires, like, 16 or 17 shots out of that gun.
Right.
And, like, some handguns can definitely hold that capacity, but I feel like his gun probably didn't. So, like, that was kind of one of the first things. I was like, he just shot 11 bullets, like, before he went into the office building without reloading or anything. Also, he had a gun on him.
Right.
Which, like, is weird, because, like, that's the first time you see him in the movie with a gun. Like, you know, he's got knives and stuff, but, like, a gun seems really weird that he would have that.
Right.
And then, obviously, like, the ATM, like, saying, feed me a stray cat, that's clearly the first sign that, like, maybe this isn't really happening, or at least maybe, like, he's just picturing this. And then, like you mentioned, the moment where he shoots the security guard point blank was kind of funny. Like, and you couldn't help but laugh at that. And then when he goes around the revolving door to shoot the woman coming out of the elevator before going back out, I was like, "All right, I'm not sure what to believe here."
Right. So, do you have like a hypothesis of what you think is real and unreal in this movie, and when that begins? If reality ends, or if reality never began.
Oh, man. See, this is largely tied into the ending. I've had so many friends that, like, insist on, like, there being a definitive answer, and I like that there isn't.
Sure.
Because that movie, to me, that confession scene at the end, and, like, him saying the confession about nothing means either one of two things. Means either he didn't do any of those things. Like, he never killed Paul Allen because the lawyer said, like, he had dinner in London with him a couple of times the week before. And he's just completely, like, had a psychotic break. And, like, maybe he's just living out, like, these fantasies in his head that, like, he's doodling in his sketchbook that Chloe 70, his secretary, finds.
Mm-hmm.
Or everyone around him is so shitty and, like, unaware, like, that they can't even tell people apart.
Right.
They're like, maybe the lawyer mistook the guy he was with in London for Paul Allen. Because, like, he didn't even realize it was Patrick Bateman on the phone.
Right.
And that's his lawyer.
Right.
Which is insane to me. And then, like, when he goes to the apartment, like, everything's painted over. So that could genuinely be the realtor preparing the place for viewing.
Right.
Or that could have been, hey, this was a murder apartment. We need to cover this up and turn it around really quick.
Right.
So I like the idea that I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, this is one of the few times, and I don't feel like it's the movie copping out either. Like, I feel like everything is justified, and every time he murders someone, with the exception of that scene towards the end where, like, he just goes on the killing spree,
right,
there's never witnesses. Like nobody sees these things happen.
Well, the one where he kills her with the chainsaw was probably the most where I'm just like, why is there no one here at this place at this point as she's running away or screaming or, you know, there's just no one else on this floor or what's going on?
Yeah, and I think that definitely lends itself to the maybe this isn't really happening kind of thing.
But with these types of movies, like, to have a definitive ending would not be fitting to the movie.
No, definitely
and
not.
I don't know if people, I mean, I think then people will just not be into these types of movies if they want an ending that's clear, because it doesn't fit how you've created this character and the story. I mean, Taxi Driver is the same way.
Yeah.
You have an ending that's there, but you are questioning it.
Yeah, it's that unreliable narrator thing.
Right.
And then when it's done right, it can be done really well. Yeah. Like, there's been a string of movies, like, especially, like, from Fight Club on, that, like, have kind of used that cop ending. Like, there's that shitty Robert De Niro movie, Hide and Seek or whatever.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Where it's like, look, if anyone's listening, fucking deal with it. You've had long enough to watch that dog shit movie.
Is that, but, like, with that kid?
Yeah, yeah, okay, Dakota Fanning.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, like, there's all these creepy things, and then he finds out, like, it's a split personality that Robert De Niro was the bad guy the whole time. I was like, okay. Fuck off! Like, or, like, Secret Window with Johnny Depp.
Oh,
like,
God, yeah.
Like, there's no reason for it. Like, it's not like they... Like, they tried you, or it's like, oh, they were under stress and they had a psychotic break. I was like, fuck you. Like, I don't think that's how psychosis works.
Right.
Like, I mean, obviously, probably to some extent, sure. But, like, it was just like, there was like a 10-year stretch where the conceit was, let's just have this all be in the character's head or something. And sometimes that works. Like, American Psycho, Fight Club, it clearly works. But then, like, I saw Shutter Island, and I was so pissed off at the ending of that. I was like, just once, I want to see one of these movies, and there's actually something happening, and it's not somebody hallucinating or internalizing it in their head or whatever.
Yeah, so many people like that movie, and it was really disappointing knowing it was Scorsese.
And I love Scorsese, I love DiCaprio and Mark Ruffalo, like, everyone who's in that movie is so good, and then... It's just so lackluster, like, by the time it gets to the end of it.
That could be a really interesting thing to look at. Because, yeah, like, the late 90s, early 2000s had a lot of these really good movies.
Yeah.
And combine it, like, you throw Sixth Sense in there, so then people kind of were like, oh my god, I'm surprised by this kind of twist.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, there was probably a ton of mid-2000s movies, now that I think about it, that tried to do it.
Yeah.
And just, it was just a blockbuster approach to it.
Yeah.
It was a cheapening of it. Like, I thought, have you seen Identity?
Yeah, yeah.
It felt the same way, too.
Yeah, it's like, oh, wow, this is, like, a really good, scary slasher kind of flick.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, come on, are you fucking kidding me? It's in, like, an autistic convict's head or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I think part of the thing that's frustrating, too, is, like, a movie like Sixth Sense, obviously, it's a very good movie. I feel like even without that twist, like, it was a good twist, but, like, even up until that point, like, the movie was still really good at what it was doing.
Right.
So, it wasn't necessary that it was there, it just enhanced it.
Yes.
It wasn't like the movie was dog shit and limped along until it got to that reveal. It was like, wow, this is really good, I'm really kind of intrigued by this, like, what's going on? And then I was like, oh, well, okay, that's weird, I didn't see that coming.
Right. And then And in the realm of Shyamalan, it then became sad because I think he felt a necessity to always have
to do it all the time. Yeah,
that, and that's not what a movie's about. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Like the only other movie of his that I really really liked was Unbreakable. To me personally, I think Unbreakable is his best film.
Unbreakable was really good. Those, like, first two were very good.
Yeah, and that, like, The Village, I like it. And I hate it because of the twist.
Right.
Lady in the Water is a weird movie, but I can appreciate that he was trying to do something different. But again, it's like, there was no reason to have twists in there, and you just threw them in. Signs, same thing.
Right.
It's like...
It's... And calling it a twist is weird, too.
Yeah.
In and of itself. That came about from it. But you had these movies, like... The Crying Game, I love.
Yeah, yeah,
and I love The Usual Suspects, too.
Yeah.
And it was just, them as a whole, as films, were fantastic.
Yeah.
And then you just had this holy crap
that punch
moment.
That reveal.
Yeah. Which, I mean, in The Usual Suspects case is, you know, less than a minute in the end of the movie.
Yeah.
In The Crying Game, it's, what, like a half hour left or
yeah.
But it's just such a shocking reveal that it's like, wow. It's just a wow moment that only enhanced it, like you said.
Exactly, yeah.
It's not
like up until that point, the movie was still really good.
Right. It's not like, I better force this in to make sense for whatever I just made.
And it's such a cop-out a lot of the time. But yeah, like, Usual Suspects, another one of my favorites. It's definitely one that I want to do on here at some point, too. But, like, and this, I was like, I went into it knowing the twist before I'd ever seen it, because I didn't see it until, like, probably 10 years after it came out, so of course I knew.
Yeah.
And same with Crying Game. I've actually never seen The Crying Game, but I know exactly what happens, because, again, that one's been around for almost 20 years.
Okay.
So, like, I went in, I still watched it, and, like, I told my friend about it. She's like, oh, you finally watched it. Like, what'd you think? I was like, well, I knew about the twist. She's like, oh, God, did it ruin the movie? I was like, no.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it kind of, like, it sucked not getting, like, that reveal, like, when it's offered to me, because I knew, but, like, it didn't make the movie less good. Like, it's still a great fucking movie. Like, it's a great script. Everyone in that movie is on their, like, A game. Like, it's easily the best thing Stephen Baldwin's ever done. Right. So, like,
Yeah,
like, it's still a great movie.
Yeah.
And it doesn't hinge on that conceit.
No, and, I mean, you still have no idea how it's implemented. You know it's gonna happen, but you don't know how. And it even stands on itself just in the manner of how they do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. I think we're about at the end of our time. Okay. Is there anything you want to wrap up, say, before we close out American
I'm
Psycho?
I'm really happy we did this.
Yeah, me too.
Because, like I said, it's been truly, what, like 13, 14 years in the making for me to watch this movie, and I really wanted to, and to watch it with you is good. You appreciate movies just as much as I do.
Definitely.
Especially movies of this nature. So, yeah, man, thanks a lot.
No problem. It was fun.
We'll do it again sometime with something else.
Cool, man. All right, well, thanks, Sumac. And thank you guys for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Join me next time as I take John Hoffner and Chris Paw through Francis Ford Coppola's Vietnam Heart of Darkness take Apocalypse Now. Make sure that you keep checking out new episodes, subscribe to us on iTunes, like the page on Facebook as we head towards our first live show April 22nd at Shadowbox Live with Ghostbusters. Send any questions, comments, suggestions for the show to howhaveyounotseenthispodcast@gmail.com, and we'll catch you next time.